Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Pleasure, as always, to have Robert Hormats with us, particularly today before the president speaks in Warsaw. Bob Hormats is vice chair, as I said, of Kissinger Associates and former undersecretary of state for economic growth, energy, and the environment. A defense of Western civilization. What are you expecting to hear from the president today? Tell us a bit about the location in which he'll be speaking this morning.
Well, it's a great place to speak because it's really the center of action for a lot of things that have happened in the Polish movement toward being part of a part of Western Europe again, or a part of the whole Europe again, the sort of resurrection of Poland from a political and an economic and a social point of view. It's an opportunity for him to underscore the fact that liberal Western democracies with values of pluralism, tolerance, openness to the exchange of information, a free, untrammeled, unintimidated press, freedom of speech, all these things are part of Western values that unite Europe and the United States and have for centuries. The question people are going to want to hear answered is, does the United States still support those values, and does it still support the institutions that embody those values, NATO for common security, cooperation on trade for more openness, cooperation in supporting the freedom of the press, cooperation in resisting Russian interference in the politics of Western Europe and the West in general. The Russians clearly are trying to undermine stability among European countries within Europe and the NATO alliance. Is he going to stick up for those values and those institutions in a full-throated way? That's what people are going to want to hear.
Indeed, there was
a background presentation.
Yeah, briefing before this. A reporter asked if he was going to stand up for Article 5 of NATO, and the senior administration official said that he wasn't going to step on the president's speech. We'll listen to see what the president has to say about NATO in particular. A president often sets the table before a summit like the G20 coming up here in Hamburg with a speech like this. I wonder if he's going to do that more effectively with this speech or the tweets that we saw yesterday. Of course, he'll be meeting on the sidelines with the president of China, among other world leaders. But he's used Twitter ahead of this meeting to comment on trade, to comment on North Korea. How's that going to shape what he's going to have to say there?
Well, I would say that if he wants to appear presidential and appear to be the leader of the United States with a credible aura about him, he ought to put his cell phone away, his smartphone away, and give a serious speech along the lines I have indicated and that most presidents do, like Reagan at the Berlin Wall, for instance, or Kennedy when he gave his Ich bin ein Berliner speech. A speech of that quality would go a long way. The Europeans want reassurance that the United States is still their ally in a strong way, still supports Western values, still supports the kind of institutions that the United States took the lead in developing after World War II. These are the things they want to hear, and they want to hear it in a comprehensive statesman-like speech. They don't want to hear it on Twitter.
Let me ask you just about the agenda of the G20. It was supposed to center on trade. It was supposed to center on climate. I'm sure there will still be discussions of both of those issues. But how has what happened on July 4th over the Sea of Japan changed what this agenda is going to look like?
Well, it certainly has changed it. You're absolutely right. The Koreans did this, in fact, to focus more attention on them. So there are a number of very important meetings. One is the one you mentioned, the president meeting with Prime Minister Abe and President Moon, the new president of South Korea, to demonstrate unity. What the United States does vis-a-vis North Korea has to be done hand in hand with our two major allies in the region, South Korea and Japan. So that meeting will be important. There's another meeting that's not talked about much. President Moon is going to meet with President Xi Jinping. That will be a very interesting conversation as well, because the South Koreans want to work with the Chinese. And I think the United States still does, although it doesn't seem to be indicating that very much anymore. But the North issue is very complicated because they do have formidable military capability, leaving aside their intercontinental ballistic missiles and their nuclear capability. Mm. They have tactical capability of destroying a very wide swath of the northern part of South Korea. Now, the United States and its allies in the end would prevail over the North, but a lot of carnage could take place in the interim. So this has to be worked out very carefully with the Chinese and the Russians, but particularly with America's Japanese and South Korean allies.
Robert Hormats with us. Good morning, everyone. David Gurr and Tom Keene, Bloomberg Surveillance Worldwide, coast to coast. Good morning to the Polish Americans across this nation, a huge part of the American population. The running statistic is 7% of Chicago, but that barely does justice to the American reach of the Polish community. We've been looking at the president in Warsaw, at the royal, castle, rather, which was largely rebuilt, I'm told, by American donations, David, coming out of World War II. And then David will be here. Have you been, Ambassador, have you been to Kryszczynski Square in Warsaw?
I have not, but I want to. My wife's mother's family is Polish, and my wife, Catherine, and I would love to go to Warsaw and get a feel for
the old town. And the history here, Ambassador, is so important because, for example, it goes back hundreds of years, and there was the 16th century of Polish ascendancy, which many have touched on today. Ambrose Evans Pritchard mentioned that in the Telegraph. But one of the ideas here is still the legacies of World War II, and that the Warsaw Ghetto, buttressed right up against the Kryszczynski Square, packed now with people waiting for the President of the United States.
It has great symbolism, and part of the Solidarity Movement demonstrated very, very robustly in that square as well, particularly when the Pope came. So this does hold a major role in Polish history, past and currently. So it's a symbol. Squares, as we've seen in Tahrir Square and many other squares around the world, do tend to be gathering places for strong social and political movements and for big speeches. So I think, will be a very significant thing. And as I was saying, I think the speech ought to be a very clear, ringing reinforcement of Western liberal democratic values, the strength of the West in dealing with totalitarianism. This is the place to do it. Be a statesman. Use this venue to make a strong statement about American support for Europe and why Western values unite Europe and the United States.
And you want to think, David Gurr, that it'll be different than the press conference we saw an hour and a half ago, which was basically the Washington media doing an East Room press conference in Poland, was my interpretation.
Before everyone in Washington was awake, I think. Yeah.
But that was something, really something to behold, folks, the president bringing up a few other media outlets, including one over at the southwest corner of Central Park in Poland.
Yes. Ambassador Hormats, let me ask you just about the issue of Russian interference, something, as Tom says, is a hot issue here in the U.S. And I wonder if you think it's likely that the U.S. president is going to bring that up with his Russian counterpart while he's there.
So far, there's very little indication that he's going to do that. He spent a lot of time criticizing President Obama for not taking action.
And he did this morning as well, yeah.
There is something to that. I think President Obama should have taken more robust action. But President Obama is no longer president of the United States. President Trump is. And the question is, what is he going to do about it? What is he going to say to Putin about it? And it's an important issue for the United States because our democracy is precious to Americans, whether you're a Republican or Democrat. And foreign interference is something the United States has always resisted very strongly. But there's a broader message. The Russians are also interfering in the politics of virtually every country in Western Europe. So if the United States takes a lukewarm or position on this or doesn't say anything, it gives the Russians a sense, gee, the Americans don't seem to care. We can do whatever we want. And they're trying to do it in Germany. They try to do it in France. They certainly try to do it in Britain by supporting UKIP. They've supported a whole range of right-wing populist parties. And at some point, the United States and its democratic allies have to get together and figure out how to deal with this issue. It's corrosive of democracy. It does destabilize and will continue to destabilize European governments. Mm-hmm. It didn't work so well in France. Thankfully, Macron won. But the Russians try to use this, and Putin understands how to use it. And I think it's a threat to the stability of Europe and our friendship with Europe and our alliance.
If you're just joining us, folks, thrilled to bring you Robert Hormats this morning with the G20 meeting in Hamburg, Germany, coming up. And, of course, the president today in Poland amid some interesting sights. I believe I see right now a gentleman in a Union Army Civil War hat in some form of American uniform, it seems. Maybe he's involved with someone. So he may be speaking with Mr. Kushner and Ivanka Trump.
I think they are attending
as well. David, help me here.
You're right.
My eyes are fading. Hormats got 20/20 vision.
Fear from across.
We've been privileged, folks, the last number of days by a team. David and I have a team with Francine Lacroix that just gets us the best minds we can find. One of those is Barry Eichengreen of the University of California at Berkeley, our preeminent economic historian and student of international economics. Professor Eichengreen, good morning to you. I guess we're globalizing Europe right now. We're told interview after interview it is a better economy, an ascendant economy. With the funeral of Helmut Kohl and with this important G20, would you suggest that Europe has reached escape velocity from decades of eurosclerosis?
I was in Hamburg yesterday, actually, Tom, and asked a very similar question. My answer was curb your enthusiasm. I think people were overly pessimistic about Europe for the last 3-4 years, thinking the Euro and the European Union were in the throes of an existential crisis. Now they think escape velocity in all of Europe is becoming German economically. I think they still have banking problems, growth problems, and the challenge is not entirely behind them.
Well, I don't know if you were listening to what the president just had to say. He didn't talk about trade in specific, but as I mentioned, I think trade is going to be a big issue at the G20. What do you make of what's been floated and reported, discussions within the White House that the president and his staff are weighing a 20% or more tariff on goods, on metals and other goods? What could the ramifications of that be if such a thing were to be implemented?
I think the ramifications would be dire, in fact, because no one would take it lying down. The Europeans would retaliate in some form. The Chinese would retaliate in some form. And that would jeopardize, I think, not only economic cooperation, but cooperation on North Korea, which is going to be not the the subtext, but the text of the G20. This president is frustrated on tax reform, healthcare reform, infrastructure spending. Trade policy is the one thing he can do, and there's a real danger he will do it.
In that speech just a few minutes ago, he talked about the importance of a community of nations. He said, we are the fastest and the greatest community. Can you have a community of nations that isn't tied together, at least in part, by multilateral trade agreements?
Trade, I think, is a critical glue here, and the United States is going to learn in the same way that the UK is learning as a result of Brexit, how hard it is to go it alone, and the advantages of having a multilateral framework, be it the EU in Europe or the WTO in the case of the United States.
Well, I'm sure, Barry Eichengreen, that you're a critic of what was called Navarro-Ross or Ross-Navarro, which was a more zero-sum, neo-mercantilistic approach of this administration. Have you seen an amendment or change by this administration to a more traditional, modern, post-World War II trade policy?
I think there has been some progress or evolution in the rhetoric since January 20th. That we're not talking about slapping across-the-board tariffs on everyone, or even across-the-board tariffs on China, Mexico, whomever, but trying to target egregious violations, specific products, and so forth. But I do not hear progress in the rationale for these tariffs, et cetera.
Are you teaching at Berkeley that we are beleaguered? Like if I look at something like steel, is the president onto something there with Secretary of Commerce Ross that we've got to defend our steel markets?
I think we need to defend the steel users equally in the same way that coal is not the future of the United States. Steel is not the future of the U.S. economy either. That's what I would tell my students.
What is the future?
Well, I think the future is information technology. I live on the West Coast, after all. The future is artificial intelligence. The future is all the services that are going to go along with that. And I think there is a growing amount of evidence that we're going to need human beings to educate the machines, train the machines, and work with machines. So the jobs are still going to be there if the education and training that are the prerequisites are put in place.
And who's best equipped to provide that? Is that something that should be done, engineered at the federal level, at the state level, by companies themselves? Who's the best trainer?
The system that's worked in the United States over the years has relied very heavily on federal-state cooperation, which is not a happy response given the difficulty the federal government and states like mine are currently experiencing and working together. In Europe, they rely on companies and trade associations, employers associations, and unions because they have unions. That is much harder to do in the United States. We lack the framework for letting the private sector lead in terms of providing the training that workers need.
Let's come back with Barry Eichengreen of Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley. We'll continue this discussion on international economics. And this is a real pleasure now, folks. Thank you, Professor Eichengreen, for being with us today with Berkeley. Roberto Azevedo is a director general of the World Trade Organization. One of the more recent director generals has been Pascal Lamé. Mr. Azevedo is from Brazil, a lifelong diplomat, and he joins us now on a new and striving World Trade Organization. He is, of course, in Hamburg for the G20 meetings. Director General, good morning. There must be a new WTO that moves on from Doha. What will the next WTO look like?
Good morning, David and listeners. I think the WTO is on the path to more delivery. I think we had pretty good ministerial conferences, both in Bali and Nairobi. A lot was achieved. We reached the Trade Facilitation Agreement, which is the biggest deal in the history of the WTO, eliminated export subsidies for agricultural products, expanded the Information Technology Agreement. So the new WTO has to be something that builds on top of all this, and we're working very hard on that.
What's your level of engagement been like with this administration in the U.S.? I've talked to cabinet officials, including Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, who talk about how when it comes to trade, they want to see more enforcement. It sounds like they want to bring more cases to the WTO. What have your conversations been like with the Trump administration?
Well, I met recently in Washington, D.C. with Bob Lighthizer, Wilbur Ross, Steve Mnuchin, and all those conversations were good. Of course, what came out clearly to me is that they have, the United States, a number of concerns about global trade and how it's being conducted and the kind of agreements and deals that are in place today. We are in the early stages of this conversation. I think the first thing to do is listen. Understand what their concerns are and see how the system and other members together can agree to improve the environment for trade and global economic growth, because at the end of the day, that's the main purpose.
As you listen, do you worry that the foundation is shifting, that the role of the WTO might somehow change? If this America First thing takes off, if the direction that the Trump administration has laid out comes to pass?
I think the U.S. administration is still figuring out the details of what they want to do. I think in general, they would like to see a reduction of the trade deficit. They would like to get more market opening to the U.S. products and businesses. But I think it's the details of that is we don't know. We don't know yet. I think we're still in the process of figuring that out. Clearly, we need to talk a lot more. And I think that's what the G20 here in Hamburg is going to do, is give leaders and us, international organizations, a chance to explore some of that stuff in a face-to-face environment.
Director General, when we look at WTO, when we look at the history back to the 80s and 90s, the various GATT meetings, what was anathema was zero-sum economics. Anathema was 17th-century mercantilism. Is there a risk that we go back to that, where you sit with all the meetings you take, the delicacies of a WTO day-to-day grind? Is there a risk of a neo-mercantilist world?
I think that prospect is a catastrophe, really, if that's where we're going. I think the global economy is changing. It's changing dramatically. I don't think there is any room for that. At this point in time, people are still trying to come to grips with the new reality of the 21st economy. To begin with, tensions in the labor markets. So people are losing jobs, and they're not losing jobs, frankly, to imports. They're losing jobs to new technologies, to innovation, to higher productivity. 8 out of 10 jobs that are lost in advanced economies are lost to these things, not to trade. And of course, this is a structural change, and structural changes impose, almost by definition, a rethinking of the models that we have in place. And I think that's the painful process that we're experiencing right now.
Can trade move faster? Can deals be crafted in a quicker way?
We have two tracks, actually. One is the market access track, so cutting tariffs, improving conditions of access through quotas and things like that. And that is more easily done bilaterally or through regional agreements. Rules and harmonization of rules and disciplines, that is more productive if it's done multilaterally with more people. You can't harmonize between 2, 3, and 4. You have to have more people around the table.
Thank you so much. Roberto Azevedo, he's the Director General of the World Trade Organization from Brazil. The president with a Polish flag on the left bumper and the American flag on the right bumper, pulling up to Air Force One in Warsaw to Hamburg. Stay with us worldwide. This is Bloomberg. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Let's get right to it. We've been so distracted by international relations and politics that it is wonderful to bring in Michael Feroli of J.P. Morgan. It's always good to speak to Michael Feroli with his wonderful call on a slower potential GDP and slower American economy from a number of years ago. Michael, is all we're doing day to day is radio people, TV people like me and David, our audience in all of America, are we just still trying to get used to the Michael Feroli GDP?
Well, I don't know about that, but it does seem like we're still gradually revising down our expectations.
Yeah.
And now more and more you hear people talk about 2% growth. Like, hey, that's a good thing. That's okay. Whereas I think a couple of years ago that was viewed more of a disappointment.
You nailed the top-down analysis of looking at nominal GDP, lack of inflation, getting to real GDP, et cetera. But our new slower growth, which part of the equation is it out of? Is it slower consumption? Is it slower to zero investment? Is it a slower government? Or is it just this world trade dearth that some people talk about? Which is it?
So I prefer to look at it rather than aggregate demand, looking at it from the drivers of aggregate supply, and in particular, growth in the labor force and growth in labor productivity. And the trend in labor force has obviously been down because of demographic factors. And I think people have known that for or knew that that was coming, you know, even 10, 20 years ago. I think it's been the decline in labor productivity growth that has been more surprising. And I think that has been, as I said, people weren't expecting that, particularly after the very strong productivity growth we got in the late 90s and early 2000s. But we see a little reason why that is going to suddenly accelerate from here. In particular, as you mentioned, investment growth has been okay, but you haven't really seen the sort of rates of capital deepening that you did back in the 90s. So absent that, it's, I think, a hard story to say why we're going to see a really big acceleration in trend growth from here.
Is the yawning gap between the hard data and the soft data starting to narrow a bit?
I think so. I think, first of all, for second quarter GDP, we're tracking pretty close to 3%. So that's a good outcome. And then we've also seen some of the survey measures start to come off the boil, which really obviously popped after the election. So I do think that now that gap doesn't look all that unusual compared to a few months ago.
We were talking with Michael McKee just a few moments ago, our colleague, about retail. How does the retail picture look to you? How worried are you about what we see? Anecdotally, here a lot of stores closing in and around New York, and certainly we're hearing stories of that across the country as well. How worried are you about retail?
Yeah, so in the aggregate, consumer spending is holding up actually fairly well in, recently and in past quarters. You have had a compositional shift away from brick and mortar toward online, but you know that as I said, that the total quantum of goods and services being consumed, the growth in that still looks pretty good. Now you are going to have, I think, you know, some pretty significant reallocation effects of declining brick and mortar, and we've seen that in the jobs numbers over the past 4 months. Retail employment has declined. So, but, you know, not to make light of that, the hardship of that reallocation.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like the issue with the buggy whip manufacturers. They're out of business, but somehow we've reallocated those labor resources to other sectors. And I think with an economy at a 4.3% unemployment rate, you should probably expect most of those would-be retail employees to find jobs in other sectors of the economy.
Michael Farola Day, brought to you by my magnifying glass, brought to you by Zeiss of Germany. David Gura, stay with Michael Farola here, because I told Jamie Dimon and Davos, Michael, that you need a bigger font in your research reports, okay? I'm going to talk to Mr. Dimon about this. I mean, David, continue. I'm working on it, folks, on core inflation. Go.
Let's talk about inflation. Let's talk about the transitory nature of the inflationary headwinds we're seeing. We've heard Fed Chair Janet Yellen make the case for these headwinds being transitory, as she puts it. How hard is it for her to make that case? Are you sympathetic to the argument she's made?
I'm mostly sympathetic, as I think most of your listeners probably know. The one obvious area where you see the transitory influence is on cell phone and self-service prices, which took a big level step down a few months ago, and that has been affecting and will continue to affect at least the year-ago numbers through next spring. And that looks like it's a one-off mostly. There are some other things in the inflation data which look like they may be a little more persistent. In particular, some of these measures of rental inflation and homeowners' rent, those things have been looking a touch softer, and there are some reasons to think that the acceleration in rents we've seen is probably slowing. So I mostly agree with the chair. I do think there are some areas that bear, you know, closer scrutiny, though.
I've given up on the research report. I got a selfie stick here with the report on the end of it. I'm holding that puppy like 3 feet away from me trying to read it. Michael Farola, we were privileged yesterday to have a wonderful and collegial debate with the great Adam Posen of the Peterson Institute and John Writing for years at Bear Stearns Economics in his own shop, RDQ. And it basically devolved down to the orthodoxy of Phillips curve, traditional economics versus a neo-Vixellian market-centric, we've got to change corporate taxes view of John Writing, a much more market-based solution to our economics. Where's the Fed in this debate? Day after day, are they wedded to traditional economics? Are they in a middle ground, or are they just making it up as they go?
I think the Fed, in particular the staff and the leadership, are quite firmly in the Phillips curve tradition of viewing inflation as being driven by slack. That said, I don't think they view it as a relation that has engineering-like precision. So you are going to have lags. You are going to have uncertainties as to where NARO is. You're going to have transitory outside influences like import and energy prices. But if you look at the research coming out of the Fed, it still is firmly in a Phillips curve tradition. And as you may know, Yellen kind of earned her academic chops by working on issues related to the Phillips curve and into labor markets and wage inflation. So I think they, as I said, they're in that tradition. And also they're looking at these things at a quarterly and annual frequency, whereas, you know, we in the market sometimes get so hyper-focused on the latest event that kind of lose the big picture.
I know Kasman's guilty of that. David Gura, what Michael Feroli was talking about there, what Michael Feroli is talking about, to cut to the chase because he's too nice a guy, is Chair Yellen agrees with Adam Posen. Uh-huh. Chair Yellen agrees less so with John Riding. That's how you translate
that. Has the utility of the way that we view the Phillips curve changed? How do you see it today?
There is, I think certainly since the mid-80s, you have decreased statistical power of the unemployment rate in terms of forecasting inflation. Part of that is simply since the mid-80s, inflation has been so relatively steady, right? So when you don't have a lot of variability on the left-hand side variable, it makes it harder to identify what's driving the changes there. So you get a lot more noise and fewer big ups and down trends like you did in the 60s and 70s. So it has become less useful. But at the end of the day, you know, as they often say, you need a model to beat a model. And so far, we haven't found another model that, at least on a quarterly and annual frequency, outperforms the Phillips curve.
I've got my glasses on. I can see that, you know, we've got three more CPI reports to come before the September meeting. What are you going to be looking for in those reports? What measure do they have to be, do you think, for the Fed to judge that what they've done is accurate or is correct?
Yeah, so second quarter, core CPI ran at a 0.6% annualized rate. I think we need to see that back up above, at least above 1.5%, closer to 2% on the core CPI measure. I think if you don't see that, some of those voices of concern probably start to elevate. But again, you've seen, even with these disappointments on the CPI and the PCE, pretty steady Fed. And I think part of that reflects the fact that we've been equally surprised by how far the unemployment rate has undershot expectations. So you got these conflicting issues, which make it difficult.
Well, let's do this. Let's come back with Michael Feroli and talk about the shock and awe of what we've heard in surveillance, which is an unemployment rate that can drive lower. And there'll be no quizzes. Measuring labor force and unemployment is a squishy business. Michael Feroli with us, and I really want to dive now, folks, into the great mystery. I get a lot of mail on this. Michael Feroli, 10% unemployment. We migrate down. We get to 4.5%. And we drive ever, ever lower. Let's begin with just a simple idea of the numerator and the denominator of the unemployment rate. Who's the horse? Who's the cart? Which one matters more? The numerator of the unemployed or the denominator, which is the vast force of America?
I think it's still the numerator. And that has been, I think, in percent terms, certainly changing a lot more in recent years and explains why we've... why the unemployment rate has come down. That said, the denominator of the labor force has been a little more variable than historically it has been, and we've seen you know, some declines in labor force participation, but we think those are mostly driven by demographic trends. But I think in terms of that move from 10 to 4.3, it's really been the numerator.
Am I right? When I read those minutes yesterday, it seems like the members of the FOMC are still convinced that the unemployment rate could go lower. They are not convinced, it seems to me, that we're at full employment.
Well, it could go lower, but if it goes lower and inflation starts to pick up, then we are at full employment, right? So that it can go lower in a sustainable way or in an inflationary way. But look, the pattern has certainly been that the FOMC, as well as private forecasters, have consistently overestimated in this business cycle the unemployment rate. So it stands to reason that after a certain time, you might of making errors in the same direction, you might worry about making a similar error again. So I think it's only reasonable to think that we could undershoot expectations on the unemployment rate in the months ahead.
I'll get your perspective on the housing sector, if I could. We had a couple of conversations about that a little earlier in the week. How have the data been, and what's your sense of the degree to which that's dragging down growth here in the U.S.?
The housing
market right now, and the effect it's having on the economy overall.
Yeah. So housing's been relatively, surprisingly steady, actually, in terms of housing demand. We have seen a little bit of disappointment lately in housing construction, but overall, it looks to us like you're going to have modest growth in residential investment in the second quarter after a pretty strong first quarter. And as I said at the outset, that's been a little bit surprising because late last year we had a 75 basis point backup in mortgage rates. Normally, we would have expected within 6 months, 3 to 6 months, that would start to restrain housing demand. And instead, what you've seen is existing home sales and new home sales have been relatively steady. So we're actually pretty pleased with what we've seen overall from the housing sector.
Are we seeing two American economies, and are we getting ever more two American economies? Or with the Feroli prosperity, are we actually getting back to one economy?
Well, when you say two economies, that phrase has been used in many different ways. So do you mean a rich and a poor economy?
No, I mean the animal spirit of one economy having buoyant nominal GDP, good real GDP, better productivity, better wage growth. They go home at night with prospects forward, and another part of America that just doesn't feel like they're part of it. It's always been there, but people would suggest in the last 10 years it's worse.
Yeah, well, I think most measures of income inequality really started deteriorating in the 1970s and have continued in the decades since. I haven't seen evidence that's accelerated necessarily over the last 10 years, but certainly the mood seems to be consistent with that, and sometimes the mood is more important than the published data. So certainly some of the trends we've seen in inequality have deteriorated. Arguably, if we start to see some of the benefits of labor market tightening in the form of wage growth, that does tend to usually prop up wages at the bottom end of the distribution a little more than at the top end. So perhaps in the quarters to come, the labor market tightening can help to soften some of the disparities we're seeing. But I think most of it has been a trend issue rather than a business cycle issue.
Michael Feroli, thank you so much. Greatly appreciated. He's with J.P. Morgan. Again, we protect the copyright of our guests. You can get...
Even when the font is small.
Yeah, even when the font is small. When you get the Kasman Feroli, I know it really must read Friday afternoons and early into Friday evening. You can get that from J.P. Morgan. We're going to go to Gene Munster now with Loop Ventures, formerly with Piper Jaffray on Tesla. And, of course, we've got to ask about Apple as well. Gene, on Tesla, when do they go cash positive? When do they develop free cash flow? When do they develop some EBITDA I can believe in?
That you can believe in? It's probably 5 years. That you can actually measure? It's probably 2 years.
Yeah.
We're going to go from a negative 4% operating margin this year to minus one next year to 19 plus one. So it's going to be fractional. But that should ramp nicely as the Model 3 ramps.
Okay. Brilliantly said. Can I own the stock at 318 per share based on a 2-year, 5-year Gene Munster hope and prayer?
Absolutely. I think that this company is going to be a pioneer and a paradigm shift, not only to electric vehicles, but also to autonomy. Our work today looks at the cost of ownership. This one's a surprise. This is your data point of the day. Over a 5-year period, excluding any tax benefits that are going to go away in 2020. So let's just wipe those off the table. Owning a Tesla Model 3, which will be fully autonomous in 2 to 3 years, will be 13% more expensive than owning your everyday Toyota Camry. And I think that once that sinks in with people, that this stock is going to start to move higher.
And Air Force One now on the ground in Hamburg. We're talking with Gene Munster of Loop Ventures. Tell me about the 100 kilowatt hour batteries that Tesla's been trying to make. You look at the delays that Tesla, again, flagged here. What's the production issue been here, and how surmountable is it?
It's a major issue, just given that this is a hard thing to do, building these batteries. So they have a gigafactory. They're the only one in the world that can do this. And they came in at the low end of their expectations for the June quarter. I think that investors are overreacting in terms of this problem. Ultimately, they're going to fix it. It might take 3 months. It might take a year. But if you think about electric vehicles, our mode of transportation for the next 100 years, this near-term hiccup is something that you shouldn't be concerned about.
You look at the demand for this Model 3. What excites you the most about that vehicle? What excites you and so many other tens of thousands of people about it? Why does it have the potential to be so revolutionary?
Two reasons. First is the cost is mainstream, like we just talked about, 13% more than a Camry. And second is being fully autonomous in 2 to 3 years is going to change the paradigm. When you go and test drive cars today, they're all kind of the same, slightly different styles, slightly different entertainment systems. When we talk about a fully autonomous car, this is a paradigm shift. And that's what gets us excited about this company and their ability to be first to market with an affordable autonomous car. Mm.
Give us a quick update here on Apple. Buy, hold, sell. Gene Munster on Apple. Which is it?
I think the next 2 months, it's more of a hold. You could see the stock under pressure as investors unwind going into the next iPhone release.
Yeah.
But I think if you fast forward into the later this year for a year, 2 years out, the growth in services, I think, is a reason
right.
to own.
That's right where I wanted to go. Growth in services. Is it like a sustained double digit forever?
It is probably high double digits,
whoa.
15 to 18%
wow.
over the next 5 years.
Extraordinary. Gene Munster, thank you so much with Loop Ventures. Just love having him. We'll get him on here, folks, as we get out new, you know, Apple products and that. I've never driven a Tesla.
I have not either, no.
I drove into the place in New Jersey that had them, my Nash Rambler.
Conveniently, one right by the D.C. Bureau. There's a Tesla store, I guess they're called, right around the corner.
They wouldn't let me get out of the Nash.
It's a no Nash driver rule with the Tesla.
We can't take the Nash as a trade-in. sort of what they
so. Too valuable.
Somebody
too
sent valuable me a photo of a Nash the other day. My Nash is not as fancy as the photo. The thing must have cost $200,000.
Wow,
it was gorgeous. It looked like something Ike, you know, Ike was in. The president taxiing.
There he is. There's the plane.
Can you just see our impatient president? He's probably by the door.
Yeah, well,
like ready to let's go.
Priority to the gate. There won't be a gate. They'll wheel out the staircase as they did in Warsaw. Yeah. But the president moving quickly here from the airport in Hamburg to a meeting
when
with
does he meet
the
Mr.
German
Putin?
Chancellor. That'll be tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
On the sidelines of the G20, but a meeting one-on-one, I believe, with the German chancellor tonight. She, of course, the host of this G20 summit in Hamburg. And then he's also going to have a dinner with the prime minister of Japan and the president of South Korea. Obviously, the incident over the Sea of Japan over the weekend is going to be central to that dinner tonight.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated.